three aspects of fembots that we interact with now, and that occupy our minds now and our concerns now, and how climate change will interact with those. And the three are water, fire, and invasive alien plants. So, as opposed to taking me into the future and looking at all sorts of doom and gloom scary stories, I thought let's look at issues that face us now and how climate change are going to interact with those. I think that might be slightly more useful for us as we go forward. So that's the gist of my talk. Just thanks to a few people who have been very supportive, and indeed some who supported me throughout my career, especially Professor William Bond, who is here at UCT. Phoebe Barnard and Brian Hilton and many others over the years who have used the work. So just a little roadmap of the talk. I want to muse about fembots and the fact that this amazing vegetation type is so special, and that we find ourselves in a very special place and at a very special time when we look at fembots especially. I want to look at climate's past and future, because there's very little point, I find, in thinking about future climates and their impacts if one doesn't understand the past, the historic context. Very, very important to understand that. And it's fascinating. I want to ask very briefly, is this amazing vegetation type vulnerable or resilient? And in the context of the water invasives and fire topics, which occupy us so much today. And then a last little slide about a few thoughts about where it is from here. So just some musing about how we relate to fembots, and I hope you gradually see the irony in this. This is the entrance, at the entrance of Cape Town International Airport. Welcome to Cape Town, home to one of only seven coral kingdoms in the world. You're only one contained within a single country, and you have an elephant. It's just deliciously ironic. Thanks to Brian from Wilkins for taking this picture and noticing. You know, we desperately want to be part of Africa, of course. But fembots is a part of Africa, and we need to proudly announce that fact and really push that fact. And I think Cape Town Airport could do a lot more to announce that fact that we have this amazing coral kingdom around us. It is truly extraordinary vegetation type. We're gradually uncovering the reasons for the amazing richness of the vegetation around us. And climate has been an important driver and holder of that richness, supporter of that richness, in ways that I hope I'm going to be able to show you. So, as we, and the story is far from complete, as we delve deeper and deeper into deep time, we understand that climate change has been an important element of what's been driving this extraordinary vegetation type around us today. The context in which we now deal with climate change is one in which human, us, the most invasive species on the planet, is in direct and ever-increasing contact with this vegetation type. So we're encroaching onto fembots in many, many ways. Despite that, the biome has amazing resilience and has been able to tolerate us very well, and in fact supports us extremely well, especially in the fact that it yields pure water for Cape Town and for the surrounding towns in the Western Cape. So this is a vegetation type of great beauty, but also of great utilitarian value to us. And one has to be purely utilitarian about it, but that is an undeniable fact. So it's an immensely valuable resource to us, And the current climate is a very resilient vegetation type, full of resilient plants which can tolerate all sorts of environmental and climatic stresses, disturbance stresses. Of course, we can overstress it, and we need to understand where we're doing that. But actually, this is my drive to work every day, because I'm in Corgi. So I sent this one day going over the park, and it's just so beautiful the way that the city is lies in the of this amazing vegetation type. We live in a very special part of the planet. Of course, everywhere is special, but we're very special. And you see here a visual of the oceans, and those are the sea surface temperatures indicated by the colors warm in red and cooler in blue. And you see here this unusual tongue of cool water off the west coast of Southern Africa. It's generated largely by the southeast sea trade winds, and we get the subwelling, similar sort of thing along the west coast of Chile. But you can see quite a complicated arrangement of ocean temperatures and currents. So we have the Gallus current moving down this way, we have the cold big weather coming out this way. And then this area of mixing, very complex area of mixing. And that's important for the evolution of our climates. We don't know how stable that is. And there's a lot of work going on to look at changes. We think that the big weather is strengthening. There's some evidence for that. But we need to understand these things if we really want to understand climate. So all of our climate projection knowledge is incomplete, because our knowledge of the way the oceans function is far from complete. So we're still very much in the learning stage around what's going on with climate. The famous El Niño condition, which affects Africa through bringing drought conditions to much of Africa, only discovered in the last 3 or 4 decades. And we only now, in the last few decades, have been measuring the oceans in a way which will tell us about how El Niño and La Niña will change in the future. And that's too short of a record to have any confidence in a lot of things. So we have to move forward with a lot of uncertainty when it comes to climate change. That doesn't mean we don't know anything. We do know a lot. And those things that we do know, we need to know firmly. And we need to stand on that knowledge firmly and be able to resist the efforts of many deniers who try to undercut that firm base of knowledge. At the same time, we need to acknowledge what we know. One of the very, very special things about fables is that it derives from the fact that we, in this part of the world, are in the track. Whoops. Sorry about that. We're in the track of these westerly storm systems that in winter move further north and bring winter rainfall to this part of the world. It looks as though that process has been going on for literally millions of years, probably up to 8 or 10 millions of years. Consistent winter rainfall, and that is part of the reason behind why, despite the fact that the world's climate has changed a lot over the last 8 million years, Fynbos has managed to generate so much richness. Consistent rainfall, rainfall is very, very predictable. Even when the planet cools during glacial times, we still one of the few places in the world that still receive as much and possibly even more rainfall. So, and as a consequence, we see species that have evolved very, very specialist interactions with animals, long-time flies that only pollinate one particular species of flower, species that produce seeds that are dispersed by ants. So in time of the fire, the maximum dispersal distance is about 2.5 meters. In other words, things are designed to stay in place. And that is a very important factor. If you go to the northern hemisphere, you'll find that the species that there's much less species richness, and most of those species are adapted to the southern, our part of the world is very different from that part of the world. Of course, the northern hemisphere was covered by ice during the glacial times, as it was 18,000 years ago. So in order to survive and persist in that system, you had to be able to migrate along the distances. This is a complicated graph, but it does give you an indication of the climate history over the last half a million years. And we know it with a high degree of resolution, exquisite resolution, because it's data that are extracted from ice cores that are drilled into the ice caps in the northern and southern ice caps on Greenland. And it's quite an extraordinary story about ice. You can get ice up to almost a million years old if you go all the way down to the bottom of an ice cap. That's how long the world has been glaciated. Longer than that, but that's how long the ice has been in place. And as the ice forms every year, when snow falls, bubbles of air are trapped in that snow, and year by year, those bubbles then get compressed and ice is formed. And when we drill down to the ice, extract that air and analyze it. And from that air, you can then calculate certain things like you measure very directly the CO2 level, the temperature, and things like ice volume. So you see, this is the present. We're in a warm phase. As it was 18,000 years ago, the world was much cooler, about 5 degrees cooler. The CO2 difference was about 100 parts per million. So it was 280 parts per million before we started spewing fossil fuel CO2 to the atmosphere. Here it's about 180 parts per million. So since these times, we've increased CO2 by another 100 parts per million. The planet's only warmed by 1.7 degrees. That is enough for a 5 degree difference. So the suspicion is that there's still a lot of warming still in the works because of the ocean shifts. But as the previous interglacial, where the CO2 to begin was higher, and we can see it was a little bit warmer than the current one. So we go back in time. The majority of time over the last half a million years from this record indicates that the planet we live on is in general a cooler planet than the one that we naturally live on now. So Phobos would have been exposed to conditions about 80% of the time up to 5 degrees cooler than you currently have, even without fossil fuel warming. So my take on this is our planet, certainly over the last few million years, is a cool, adapted planet. It's gone through a natural warming cycle, and now we're adding a further warming cycle on top of that natural warming cycle. And that, to me, is one of the concerns about modeling climate change. If we do some simple modeling of the Phobos biome in blue here, under current conditions, and we just simulate what Phobos would have done as it got cooler and wetter during those glacial times, we see that there's the climate that's suitable for Phobos would be far more widespread. And this arid system would have been far wetter. And we now think that things like rhinoceros would have migrated into areas like this. So, but the core Phobos would have been there the entire time. So this system has not been displaced by climate change in the past. This has always been a solid core. And that's part of the reason why it's so resilient to these fast changes. We've also, this is also a very complicated problem. We're trying to make it as simple as possible. We've looked at bird richness and how that might have changed in the past on the scale of tens of thousands of years. And what we find is that 6,000 years ago, when the world was a little bit warmer, and 21,000 years ago, when it was a lot cooler, these areas in dark, with dark dots are current third species bridges for the present. That's with a little bit of warmer, and this is about 21,000 years ago. What we now realize, and you'll notice this, the strange shape of the Southern Cape 21,000 years ago. The reason is that because the world was 5 degrees cooler, there was much more ice locked up in the ice caps, and the sea level was about 100 meters lower than it is now. That would have exposed the southern south of Cape Town. You would have had a massive amount of land going further south. That would have been exposed. And can you imagine limestone fables extending for tens, hundreds of kilometers south of Cape Town, would have been extraordinary. So people say there'd be no extinctions due to climate change. Don't understand that that all disappeared naturally as the climate warmed about 18,000 years ago. Who knows what was there? But what's very, very interesting is that we get these climatic conditions that occasionally happen quite rapidly because of what's going on in the northern hemisphere to do with where the ice sheet melts, freezes, which occasionally cause, strangely enough, very, very warm, unusually warm conditions in our part of the world because of the way that the ocean currents are affected. And if we model those, we find that these cause a depression in the, just these little dots here are indications of the richness of birds in this area. So the number of the dots that are high up indicate that the bird species is high, and dots down here indicate that it's low. And you'll see that every time there's one of these events, these natural climate events, it suppressed the richness in this part of the world, but it never eliminated species. So we're starting to understand the climate history of this area as being one which has been stable in a sense, but has been exposed occasionally to climatic extreme events. This is very new work. We're starting to understand where, how resilient and how vulnerable the natural ecosystem here is. And I think there's still quite a lot to extract about the story about these occasional warming, rapid warming events that we need to further unpick. But the reason I show you this is to illustrate to you that the incompleteness of our knowledge, so we really are trying to explore further about how what we can learn from this. This was a glacial earth 18,000 to 21,000 years ago. It's quite shocking, actually, when you think about it. It's not an awful long time. The human species would have been a help for us. And it's no surprise to me that the evolution of cities, stable cities, required an interglacial, a warm period, to happen. Because climate change is cold, it's unproductive, plants would be growing slowly because the CO2 concentrations were low, it would have been very variable. It's no wonder to me that human society was a hunter-gatherer, migrant society, looking for opportunities between all those stresses of climate. And it's only when climate warmed about 12,000 years ago that we find that CO2 rose, that we finally started to stabilize, and scientists could develop in the way that we currently see today. But that shows you what a 100 parts per million difference in CO2 and a 5 degree difference in temperature does to the cool. Some of the projections are for upwards of 3 degrees to the warm now. So it just gives you a sense in this tree. 100 meters of sea level change. It just indicates to you that there are some risks here, and that we need to take it seriously. I'm not saying this is doom and gloom, it's all going to be a nightmare, and it's going to happen immediately, but there are some upside risks that we need to understand from this historical perspective. Fynbos has been special because, especially the mountains, by providing lots of refugia for animals and plants, would have been very important in preventing past extinction. So this is something that has allowed the species diversity in the Western Cape and in the Fynbos is the belt and mountain system in North America. As we go to the future, we look at what we've recently done to the Earth's atmosphere. These are these three panels for the sun, the global warming story up pretty nicely. We've increased the emissions of CO2 from fossil fuels. That's the CO2 level in the atmosphere. Remember, that was when the world was at its interglacial, at 180 parts of the minute, something like that, during the interglacial time. So it's a pretty good design. And then, as the world becomes really tall, there's temperature trace, we can see temperature relative to that, a slight increase in the first part of the century, probably mainly natural, a bit of pause, and then this part here, which is at least 50% driven by people. And one thing I want to point out is that the temperature we measure in the atmosphere is only a small indication of the total amount of additional energy, heat energy, that our planet has absorbed since we've started to increase fossil fuels, emissions from fossil fuels. So that shows you the heat content change because of fossil fuel emissions and in the atmosphere. But the pool that has really been heating is the ocean. Makes sense. 70% of the planet is covered by ocean. It's very absorbent of energy of infrared. And as a consequence, we see since the 1940s a huge increase in the amount of heat in the ocean. This is part of the reason why, even if we were to stop emissions today, the atmosphere would continue to warm, because some of this heat would come back out as those two systems equilibrate. So this is the thing that really should worry you. And the clearest signal of global warming is in the oceans, as the oceans warm, and obviously there's no way to explain this through changes in the sun, or galactic cosmic rays, or whatever. The CO2 warming explains this change most efficiently, most effectively. And that's part of the reason why, even though CO2 has risen a lot, we haven't yet seen the full effect in the atmosphere, because it's absorbed in the oceans, and that effect will become more evident with time. But nonetheless, we face otherwise extremely well-educated folk who latch onto things like this to say that global warming is not a problem. So this is Philip Lloyd, tactically in the Olympics, ESQCT. But he says, we've had a 40% increase in atmospheric CO2 since 45, which would imply about 1.2 degrees of warming, but we've only seen about 0.4. So has the world been cooling? What's going on? It's a really irresponsible statement, because he's trying to create skepticism in the whole climate change story. You just have to look a little bit deeper and see that actually to understand what's going on in the oceans as well. And that statement falls away completely. So this is by showing you this, I'm trying to illustrate that it's very easy to undermine your knowledge of climate change. And you need to delve a little bit deeper to understand where statements like this come from and why they're wrong. And I'm not saying they're all wrong, but this one is wrong. So, and that's one of the battles that I fight on a constant basis, just trying to say, hey guys, you haven't looked at all the information. So, let's get on to water. What's been going on with regard to water over the last century on the planet? This is an index of drought, calculated for the whole planet. It's called the Palmer Drought Severity Index. And we can see that from the 1900s, we've been getting at a global level, drier and drier, because it's mainly because of increasing temperatures. And these red Rogers there referred to areas of the world that over that long time period showed a gradually drying trend. So that gives you an indication of, and this is natural, and now the human caused effects on the water cycle. So these things are starting to emerge in the reports that we start to understand. This is a very interesting map of warming, measured warming over Southern Africa. And we see here this extremely warm band of central Southern Africa, where warming has been at least twice the rate of global warming. So the local warming normally Kalahari, Botswana, and Africa has been extremely high. The Western Cape has seen a reasonable amount of warming, but it's because of the oceanic influence suffered somewhat by the ocean. So we're sitting in a lucky situation here that being close to the oceans, our rate of warming is lower than for the interior of Africa. That's the global mean warming in blue there. And you can see that Africa is seeing fire plants. The other thing that we're concerned about for the Fynbos is these westerly rainfall systems. There's a very strong amount of evidence that suggests that as the world warms, the pressure belt that pushes these systems over Southern Africa may well shift to the south. And that would then reduce winter rainfall for the Western Cape. So that's something that's been watched very closely, and a lot of modeling has been done to see whether that's possible. That, of course, would make a big difference to our lives. There's a fantastic climate modeling group there at GCT. There's another one at CSIR in Pretoria. And this series of maps shows some of the work that's currently going on, where different global models are being applied to this part of the world to see what are the risks of this part of the world drying. You can't just trust one model, we've got to throw as many as we possibly can at the problem. And in general, we see many of those models suggest that much of Southern Africa could well dry, but not all of them do. This model doesn't suggest that. So we have some uncertainty we need to look into this further. But currently, on balance of evidence, it would appear that most of the models suggest at least Western Southern Africa could well dry. So we need to move forward with this knowledge. It's uncertain, but if that's what the majority of the studies are showing us, then we need to start planning on that basis, while at the same time continuing the research and continuing the monitoring to make sure that what direction we're going. This is what's called Region 4 in the South African Weather Services region of South Africa. And looking at the climate, the rainfall record for this part of the world back to the 1920s, I was quite astonished to see that we have experienced periods of quite severe drought in our historic time period when we had the rain. So this is the rainfall, average rainfall for Region 4. It's shown by a red dotted line. And you just have to go back to the 1920s and 30s to get a period of time where in this region rainfall drops more than 10% below the long-term average for more than a decade. And if you go back and you look in the old archives, you'll find that this is a period of great harshness for this part of the world. Farmers need to leave the land in parts of this area. And that's an actual drought, long-term drought. Now we know that we had a little drought here a few years ago at Cape Town, nearly ran out of water. What would happen if we ran into a natural drought like this to this part of the world? So that indicates that natural climate variability is something that has been highlighted by the climate change argument. We need to understand natural climate variability as well and acknowledge that we do have some natural vulnerabilities in this part of the world, which climate change could exacerbate. So, we tend to forget these things, they drift out of our memory, and we need to highlight them again and say to people, guys, this is off my mind today. Because we've lived for most of our lives here in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when our formative years. And these years were above average, above average rainfall, right? So we've lived in this South Africa that's been relatively well blessed with the climate rainfall. And maybe some of us will look forward. So this brings me to a quick discussion of Fynbos and its role in Cape Town's water supply and how we, how we address this issue. The amazing thing about Fynbos is that the rainfall in the mountains around us can exceed a meter to 2 meters per year. If you go to Europe and you have those kinds of rainfall and these kinds of climate conditions, what kind of vegetation type do you see? You see a forest. But you don't see that here. You see this low scrub vegetation. Most of the reason for that is that we have fires here that keep this vegetation in place. But the result of that is that those forests use far more water than the scrub vegetation. So our mountains yield a very high rate of water per unit of rainfall because of this amazing vegetation. If we were all to convert to forest, we lose a large proportion of that. And as you well know, the invasive aliens are starting to drive us in that direction. But so Fynbos is really critical for maintaining our water supply. Of course, as I said to Monet, you can see on the radio the other day, WWF, and he said, if you've got a hammer in your hand, you're probably stuck in a nail. So what do we do if we think we're starting to run out of our system storage is starting to run out? Well, we just build another dam. Okay. So there's the third river dam, there's our system storage along with this our drawdown. We built another dam, so we create some fillings. The building of a dam is enormously expensive. The building of a dam maybe 2.6 billion. It has a yield of about 81 million cubic meters. And I want to show you, if we manage Fynbos better and we're able to fight aliens, the clear aliens better, we could increase the yield out of Fynbos systems by 30 million, i.e., 40% of scale ground for investors of 100 rand versus 2.6 billion. This is the problem of the hammer and the nail. Effective management and stewardship of our mountain ecosystems is cheaper and gives us the same order of increased water yield as does building a dam. So, we need to think very, very carefully about costs and benefits of being involved in clearing lands versus building lands. Invasive aliens, the whole pine forest story, being contentious. I have a few more content coming up. But this I think, if anybody here is a closet pine lover, should shake your fundamentals. This is the Southern Cape. There's a sandy or monumental plantation. And these are escaped pines. In a few more fine cycles, if somebody doesn't do something about this is going to be covered in pines. Think of the drop in yield of water, the complete change to the ecosystem from these escaped pines. The cost is gigantic. And who's carrying the cost? Not the plantation, I don't know. So, this just illustrates to you what happens as an invasion gets underway and then gathers steam, and why we need to be so careful about the way that we deal with our one thing that is your questions, prototyping your answers. This is what the version. The pines do have their uses.
So this is something we need to get on top of now, start to understand now.
in the context of climate change. So let's take my vegetation right now. You may see this as a good thing. But these are the fire damage to pine plantations. Historical data from the pine plantation in the left table from remote sensing, which confirmed a radical increase in the fire damage to plantations. So plantations that are sitting within the Fynbos matrix are becoming more damaged by fire. So this is another indication that dangerous fire conditions are becoming more and more common. And this is something that we're going to, that's facing us right now, and will continue, will increase in the urgency. It's also a further reason why we need to fight AED vests, because they are fires as well. So that's my data, my story. I just wanted to muse on a few things in my last slide. And going right back to the first slide, I really think we need to advance clearer messaging about our uniqueness in an African context. We're proud of Fynbos as an African system, and we don't need elephants to make I really want to go back to firm messages relating to the linkages between today's challenges and tomorrow's challenges. The challenges that face us today and really need investment are also going to be tomorrow's challenges, and climate change can interact with those. And we're now really starting to explore those in ways that makes those investments so much more valuable. We do have large gaps in our knowledge. So we do need to be supporting new research. But critically, you've got to engage a new generation of botanists representing the full range of South African citizens in these fascinating questions. They're fascinating as well as being useful. So it's the perfect combination of science to be doing and to be attracting a new generation of young botanists. And let's start using climate change as a positive motivation and an opportunity for advancing sustainable behaviours. This opportunity is a doom and gloom thing. This is a great opportunity. We're suddenly seeing the world in new ways. It's exposing our past vulnerabilities, our current and our future vulnerabilities in ways that we can engage with art and just put our heads in our hands and say, we'll do it, because that's not the case. So thanks very much.